Every day, millions of men go to work questioning their purpose and how to leverage their gifts for the advancement of God's kingdom. Join us as we hear stories from other men just like you and me who have discovered the answer and are willing to share some wisdom they've learned along the way. Gathering wisdom is like dropping pennies in a jar. Over time, our jars fill up and overflow into the lives of others. Welcome to The Drop.
Welcome to The Drop. My name is Michael Pick, and I'm here today with Bruce Terrell. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. My honor.
All right. Thanks for joining us. So, hey, let's start off. Tell me about your family, Bruce.
Okay. Let's see. I was raised over in the Central Valley in a small town called Tulare, but I left there quite early. I was 18, and when I joined the military, what had happened is I was signed up for college. I was ready to go. I was raised in a fairly big family. There was four kids. And I got my draft notice. I was a little older than most of my classmates. I got my draft notice while I was still in high school. Not the thing you want to see, especially during the Vietnam War. So I had a very low number. So I knew that by the time the summer was over, I would be in the Army, and by Christmas, I would be in Vietnam. And that wasn't going to work for me. I admire all the guys who were able to do that. That wouldn't be me. So I started looking around, and I found I could get a great education in the Navy. And it was an education in doing something that exactly what I wanted to do. I'm pretty good at math and physics, and I wanted to be in engineering, and I had already figured out, I kind of know what I want to do. I'm not that aimless. I wanted to be in either aeronautical or nuclear engineering. Mm-hmm. And so I found out I could go and get a great education and ride submarines at the same time. So that's what I did. And I spent I signed up for 6 years, but I actually spent 8 years in the Navy. And yeah.
So at 18, you went to the Naval Academy or boot camp, or where did you go?
Yeah, it wasn't the Naval Academy. I was never an officer. It was I went to boot camp, and then they sent me to 2 years worth of schooling, okay. Which is probably about the longest you can get as an enlisted person. And in first a trade school of sorts, and then the nuclear engineering part of it, which was a year. And it taught you all about the physics and the chemistry and thermodynamics, and then you actually operated a power plant out in the Idaho desert, believe it or not. They had two submarines out in the Idaho desert.
How interesting. So did you go to boot camp in San Diego?
I did,
okay.
Yes.
And so you went to your training schools where you learned your MOS.
Right.
What drew you to, what was your interest in being a submariner? I mean, of all things, like, I want to be on a submarine. How did that happen?
Well, one thing is, it wasn't Vietnam.
Okay, oh, gotcha.
There's first and foremost. Uh-huh. And it just sounded exciting.
Okay.
And so I spent 2 years in school. As soon as I finished school, they asked me to stay and teach. So I stayed and taught for another 2 years. And then I went to a submarine out of the East Coast. And then, so this was during the Cold War. So we would fly, it was a two-crew submarine. That way the submarine could stay at sea all the time. And we had 16 ICBM missiles on board.
Oh my.
So we were truly an end-of-the-world machine. And so, but I was in the back in engineering, operating the reactor plant. And so we would go up north of the Soviet Union and be hidden for 2.5-3 months.
Underwater the whole time?
The whole time, right.
Wow, how many people were on the submarine with you?
120.
Wow, that's a lot of men.
It was a lot of people, yeah.
Wow, that just
very tight.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. What was life like on a submarine north of Russia for 2 to 3 months?
First off, it's really cold because you're at the Arctic Circle.
I bet.
But you know, we had heaters and all that. But anyway, it was exciting. It was boring and then exciting. There was so much engineering that it was just fascinating to keep learning all about it. And part of submarines is you don't just do your job, you have to learn everybody else's job. Mm-hmm. And so, gosh, you learn how to do everything. And so anyway, it was very, very interesting. One of the more interesting things is you immediately go to an 18-hour day. Oh. Because it's three sections, so it's 6 hours on watch, 6 hours of off, which includes a lot of maintenance and training and various things, and 6 hours of sleep. So you do that 7 days a week for 3 months, and then you come up for air and go home.
Oh, wow. What was that moment like, I guess, after that first run under the water? What was that moment like when you finally got outside again?
Okay, the strangest answer to that is the earth really stinks.
Oh, how funny.
You just get used to your smells.
Okay.
And so in reality, the submarine really stinks. Okay. And but as soon as you breathe it, the sea air, it was just, it's like for the first couple of minutes, you're going, my, that is an offensive smell. But then you get used to it. And of course, then you go back down and you go, oh, no, that's the offensive smell.
So walk me through. So you spent 6 years in the Navy?
Eight
years, I'm sorry.
And I stayed an extra two.
Okay. And after the Navy, what was next for you?
What was next for me is I started college to finish my degree, but ran out of money real quick because I was married and had two kids by that point. So we'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. And so I got a job at Diablo Canyon. And so I was blessed to come work where we used to vacation.
Okay.
So I got a job at Diablo Canyon in 1980, I started on, and worked out there for 30 years and retired in 2010. And then I was blessed to come back as a contract instructor for a while, for about 4 years, and then I retired for good.
Okay, good for you.
Yeah.
So what did you do out at Diablo?
Pretty much identical to what I did in the Navy. I taught a lot. I was an operator, and then I taught a lot. Probably two-thirds of the time I was out there, I was either a teacher or else mid-level management in training management. And so I taught operators and engineers how to classroom, but a lot of simulator time. So we had a full scope simulator.
So when you say operator, and just for people that aren't listening, we're talking about a nuclear power plant,
right?
Diablo. So what does an operator do? What does that look like?
It's if you've seen pictures of the control room, it's a very complicated control room. And so it's operating not only the reactor, but also the all the steam plant and the electrical plant. And so it's a very interesting place. It's very complex, and you teach them how to react in any situation, from a minor bistable fails to a major loss of coolant accident.
What is a bistable fail?
Oh, I'm sorry. Just a little electrical failure,
okay,
to all the way up to major breaks that would cause a major accident. So you teach them all about how to operate, and it tests them, a lot of testing.
So with your run at working in a nuclear power plant, did you enjoy teaching or actually working more? What were you
teaching,
more predisposed
teaching.
To?
Okay. Probably the highlight of my career was teaching in a simulator.
In a simulator simulates a nuclear power plant?
Yeah, it's identical in every way to the control room.
Okay.
And we tied to what used to be a very large computer. Now it's like a laptop. Not quite a laptop, but pretty close.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's it simulates everything that could go on. It gives you the exact alarms and you name it.
You ever have any scary moments out, like Chernobyl, like scary moments out at Diablo? I'm sure everybody asks you that, so.
No.
Okay. Everything was smooth.
Okay. And except when we were doing the crazy drills, things that almost defied logic, then... Yeah, it wasn't scary for me. I'm the one who was instigating it.
Okay, so preparation is key.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, explore it a little bit. I mean, it's interesting as an 18-year-old to want to go into something like
right.
this. What was it in your childhood or your education that, or maybe your God-given gifts, that motivated you to become interested in engineering and then nuclear power?
Not sure I've ever really thought about that. I always have done very well in math. And like very bad in like English.
Okay.
So I guess that kind of definitely points you towards engineering degrees. It was math and physics. I enjoyed that stuff always.
And in this time frame, was nuclear power a big thing or was it a growing thing?
It was a growing thing.
Okay, because like, growing up with me, it's a known thing. So
yeah.
Like this is the new up and coming thing.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that's another thing to look at it.
Okay.
My true desire growing up was to be go to the Air Force Academy and be a jet pilot and an astronaut.
Okay.
But I applied for the Air Force Academy and didn't make it. Okay. So went with plan B.
Okay. So you mentioned along the way that you picked up a wife and a couple of kids.
Now that's the highlight of my life.
Okay. We'll talk about that. Give me a snapshot of your family now, and then we could go backwards and talk about the beginnings of your family.
Okay, good way to look at it. I'm married. I've been married for 49 years.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
That's a long time. But it's obviously more testament to her than me. I've got two kids. They're twins. They're 43 years old. One lives local and one lives up in Santa Rosa. They're both married. Both have two kids. So I've got four grandkids and two kids and two kids-in-law.
That's amazing. Oh, how old were you when your twins were born?
Let's see. I got married when I was 19.
Wow.
And the twins were born when I was 25.
Okay, so you're a young man.
Very young, yeah. But Jerry and I met in high school. Mm. And so we pretty much fell in love in high school. It was one of those ones that probably not supposed to work, but did.
Okay.
So we've been together. She wasn't quite 16. Mm-hmm. And I was just turned 18, I think. And we got together then, and then I went in the Navy. She graduated a year after I did from high school. Mm-hmm. And we got married, a month after her 18th birthday.
Wow. Man, 49 years ago.
49
That's impressive.
Years.
How was it when you were deployed and under the water? Were you able to keep in touch with her, or was it radio silence completely?
Yeah, it was absolute silence.
Wow.
Yeah, you have no contact.
Okay.
They did let you do, they called them family grams. Mm-hmm. So she could send a message to me, but nothing from me to her.
Okay.
But the message was like kind of almost humorous. It was like 20 words.
No.
And it had to be very generic. Love you, miss you, blah, 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 you know.
When you were under the water, I know this is kind of a silly question, but were you guys aware of, like, current events? Or was it literally like a little bubble under the water?
Kind of halfway between there.
Okay.
It's probably much better now, but back during that time in technology, they would broadcast across the ocean, and you could pick up, when you picked up these family grams, you could also pick up news. Mm-hmm. But it would come out on a teletype, and it was, most of it didn't make sense, you know, because it would be like kind of garbled, but you could tell some very basics. So pretty much you didn't know.
Okay. So you come back and you're like, what just happened
right,
in the world?
Right.
It's kind of crazy.
Exactly.
So moving forward a little bit, you've had this successful family, so
yes.
Talk to us a little bit about where faith came into your life, where you learned about your faith and the things you've done to develop your faith.
Okay, good. Just as my education was more unconventional, which, by the way, I did go back and finish my degree, so that was nice. But my faith, I grew up in a Christian family. My mom, she was a saint, and so she was always a tremendous example for us. My dad, also in the faith, but not as, let's put it this way, not as straight and narrow as he could have been, which had effect on me for a lot of years. So I followed the faith. I was baptized when I was 12, 13 or something. And when I joined the Navy, it really puts you out in the world. And so we still went to church some, but certainly not regularly. Jesus was not really a part of our daily lives. And that kind of followed after we got out for a little while. And then, good story. One day we were working in our yard, and this couple with their child on their shoulder came walking up and said, you know, we're not even from this area, but we just wanted to pray with you and encourage you to go to your local church. And so it was like, really? Turned out they were from Santa Maria, and they had come all the way to Los Osos and just encouraging people. So
you're just walking around
yes.
praying for people.
Yeah, it was the coolest thing.
That's remarkable.
And so so we had some things going on with mostly some friends. And so it was a little heartbreaking, marriages breaking up and all that. So we talked to them, they prayed with us, and we both just kind of looked at each other and almost kind of couldn't hardly believe what we just experienced. And then about, an hour or two later, my daughter had a friend over, and her father came to pick them up. Goes to this church, actually, Dave Mayfield, and invited us to come to Easter church. And we hadn't been to church in several years. So we go, okay.
He's coming for you.
He's coming for me. Yeah. So it was like, wow, that's interesting. So we went to church and never looked back.
Wow. So when you came back to church after a little pause, what was it that attracted you back? What happened that was like, okay, I'm all in. I'm going to do it different from my dad. What happened?
Good question. First off, coming back to church felt like home. It wasn't this church. It was a church in Morro Bay. And it just felt like home. Everything felt right to come back and be with family, if you want to look at it that way. I had struggled for a long time because my dad, a lot of hypocritical actions as far as not the best example of being a Christian in his marriage and in his fathering and all that. And I was determined not to do that. I took that being hypocritical as something I will never do. And so as a result, it kind of pushed me away from God because I knew I was human and I knew I couldn't help but be somewhat hypocritical. But I finally realized, starting to go to church, coming back home to church, that it's okay, that God loves me and God accepts me for who I am and that I'm going to screw things up no matter how hard I try. And so it allowed me to really grow in my faith, and that's just continued. I feel like I've been on an upward trend, but as my good friend Armando said, kind of going up a hill, back and forth.
Switchbacks.
Switchbacks, yeah. You know, one day I'll do great, another day, not so good.
So how old were you and your wife when that occurred, when that random couple showed up and prayed for you in your yard?
Probably 34, 35, somewhere around in that age.
Okay. And I've gotten to know you, and you're not just a go-to-church guy. Like, you're not just a guy that shows up on Sunday.
Right.
So in your mid-30s, when you re-engaged with your faith, what did you do immediately to start fostering that and build that wall around our internal hypocrisy?
Oh,
what did
good,
you do?
Good. Bible studies, men's group, a lot of Bible studies, getting to know him better, serving. Studying, serving, that was kind of a big part of it. And so leading Bible studies, that's when you don't really know that much. If you volunteer to teach something, you learn it. I think we've all figured that one out. And so my knowledge went up a lot, but also my relationship with God went up. And so and the same goes with serving. And that's always been a very important thing to me, whether it's leading Bible study or being in, you know, leadership boards or whatever. And it's still important to this day. So after I retired, I've gotten more into it, I guess.
Let me take you back a little bit to this mid-30 range when you re-engage and started going to church. Did you have some differences in the way you approached work? Because you still had a really long career at Diablo, still working in the power industry. What kind of things did you do different after re-engaging, and how did you bring your faith into the workplace?
A great question. I would love to give an answer that is, wow, I turned out to be the best person ever. So we'll just leave it there. No. It helped me to understand people and to love people more. But of course, not everybody who would work with me would say that that would be the truth. So,
are you a heavy out there?
No, I wouldn't. I'm a people person. So I would never say that I was heavy, but, you know, did I engage in off-color jokes and various things? Of course. And it did affect my working relationship, and there was definitely times that I was able to pray with people when they were going through a hard time. A couple times that actually got me in a little bit of trouble, but that's okay. It's worth it. But it gave me more direction, and it helped ground me, I would say that, and be more empathetic to people.
And what kind of, your twins were already born.
Yeah.
So what kind of changes did it make in your home life that you re-engaged service and study and going to church? What kind of things did happen in your home after this kind of re-blooming of your faith?
I've always been very much of a family person. My kids and now my grandkids are the most important thing, you know, other than God in my life and my marriage, obviously. But I'm very much of a family person. And so I've always been a very engaged dad and a very, very loving dad and grandfather. But I think perspective and a realization of the love of Christ, you know, and it frees you up to be more loving. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would say it really helped in that aspect.
Okay. And I know that you mentor just about everybody in town. Everybody I talk to is like, I know Bruce. So, you know, I've always, I look at you in phases and not to kind of, but you were a student, then you kind of lived it, and now you're teaching in the ways that you teach. Now you're retired and you serve. What kind of activities do you engage in? Because you're out there doing it, pouring into others. What kind of activities do you engage in so that you're poured into?
Oh, okay. I'm in a home group that we've been together for, about 11, 12 years now. And there's only two other couples, but it is truly family. And I just love those people to death.
So what does a home group look like? What does a home group do?
We meet every other week, and we are always studying a book of the Bible, a lot of times through a video series, and then we'll talk. This particular home group has been really good because we rotate the facilitation of it between the three guys. And so every week you get a different perspective of that. And so we study. We spend a lot of time, you know, visiting and being in each other's lives, and then we spend a lot of time in prayer with each other. So being in a home group, I try to do a daily Bible reading and prayer. For me, the most effective thing is that the Bible in a year, those books and stuff, I have it on my phone now. So I've done that, 10 times at least. And that gets me in the Bible, you know, on a daily basis. So that's been a huge help. And then I try my best to be part of a worship service every week, because that's just so important to me to be part of, as Pastor Dave puts it, you know, the scattered community to the gathered community, a collective worship, and just to see others like you worshiping God or not like you, even better. It really reinforces it.
Wow, that's remarkable, you know, coming from this kind of engineer to say that worship, because sometimes, you know, personality types don't hit those points, so.
I'm not very stereotypical as far as engineer.
No. Yeah, so it's a compliment, so forgive me for bunching an engineer into one group, but to hear you say worship is so important and once a week, what fostered that? Where does that come from, or is that just a longing from within you?
Yeah, I think it's a longing within me, and I think being forced at first to come to church every week when I was a child, and having that as part of our routine really helped. And I strongly encourage parents to do that, even if the kids are reluctant, because it does instill that sense of home that you come back to. And so when you come to a worship service and you're praying and it's a collective thing, it's home. And that's important.
Wow. So as you sit here now that you're in retirement, you're still engaged. What does this phase look like moving forward? What does that look like for you as far as continuing to serve and study the body?
Okay. I'm very engaged with my family. So with my kids and my grandkids, we have an excellent, excellent relationship. And I couldn't be more blessed by that. So that's a big part. Serving, I serve with the food bank once a week on food distribution, and then deliver some food for people in Los Osos. I It's where I live, so I can't participate in the church one, but I do there. Mentoring, men's ministry. I do a lot of men's ministry and on the board and stuff now. So finance and kind of stay pretty busy with all of that.
It sounds like it. So do you see this being what your future looks like, staying in this lane?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm enjoying it. It's a absolutely amazing time of life. Mm-hmm. I'm very blessed to be what I'm able to do right now.
Wow. So one of the questions I've been asking at the tail end of these conversations is, you now looking back, what advice or wisdom would you share for maybe an 18-year-old you or a 25-year-old you or a 34-year-old you at different phases? What would you share that maybe to avoid some of the issues that had come up in your life? What would you say to that person?
I've got a couple of things, but let me hit something else before I do that, if I could.
Oh, please do.
When Mike came up with the idea of the drop, Mike and I are friends, and I thought it was just an amazing idea. And I was just telling, Mike and I were just talking about this a few minutes ago. My grandson, who's almost 15, and I will get together, he lives in Santa Rosa, but we'll get together on Zoom, or FaceTime rather, and watch the drops together. And whenever they come out, and we'll pause it and talk. And this has been, these 30 minute, whatever they are, drops has been a great time for me to connect with him, and we'll talk about life and what that person's saying and how it applies. So I would strongly encourage anybody with kids and any, you know, above a certain age, maybe 10 or something, or grandkids, in my case, to do this with your kids or grandkids, because it's a great time to connect, and this may be the exception, but there's usually a lot of wisdom that comes out and important things to talk about. So that was the little maybe sales pitch, if you want to call it that, but it's a great thing to do with these kids.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well deserved. As far as wisdom goes, the thing I would do differently is I spent way too much energy worrying about titles, professional titles, and did I climb the ladder of success or something at the company? And, oh, wait a minute, why did he or she get that promotion instead of me? I would say absolutely do not worry about it. It's not important. God's going to take care of you, and you don't need that ego boost of having a title of whatever. So that if I could have done that, I think my professional life, which probably spilled over into my personal life, would have definitely been better. I would definitely tell myself that. The piece of advice that I would reinforce came from, I just heard, it was best discussed by this rabbi named Steve Ledger. And it's in a book, The Beauty of What Remains. But when Bob Goff asked him what was the most important thing, and he said, your job in life is to be a good ancestor. And that was one of the most profound statements I've ever heard in my life, that you will affect your kids and your grandkids, but of course your great-grandkids or great-great will never know you, but you're creating somebody, molding, or that will help the great-great-grandchild, the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild. And so your name will never be mentioned, but you're being a good ancestor. And so it's not your golf score. It's not whether you were the vice president of a company. It's, did you create a good ancestor? Are you being a good ancestor? And like I said, it's always kind of been very, very important to me, but I never had it put into such concise words before, such wise words before. So yeah, that would be it.
Wow, that very, very wise. Thank you. So what things have you done after this motivational quote about being a good ancestor, and you've built a very solid life about family and faith, what other things can we do as men or women to make sure we are good ancestors?
Good. I remember when I would first come home from work, I'd set my briefcase down and I would get on the ground and say, don't attack me, I'm just going to sit here and whistle. And that was the signal to the kids to come tackle me, and we would wrestle. And I bring that up as like almost a humorous example, but be there for your kids. Be there. Set your briefcase down. Put your phone down. Be there for your kids. Be there for your grandkids. I FaceTime with my grandkids on a pretty regular basis, and sometimes it'll go on for a half hour or longer. And so being there for your kids, wrestle with them, just show them how much they're loved. And that's probably a great piece of advice. And do your absolute best to maintain a relationship with your adult children. Set it up while they're growing up to where you can have a loving relationship between adults. So, yeah.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So, Bruce, this has been a remarkable time with you, getting to know you better in your life, but I kind of want to ask you one more question. So, you know, you've long time in the faith, 49-year marriage. So share some of the things you've done to keep that going. I mean, you have the young, passionate phase, then the kid-raising phase, the grandparent phase, the retirement phase. What are some of the things you and your wife have done to keep that fire going?
Oh, okay. So first off, it's always better with God. So the times where we've walked away have been the times where we've had more problems than normal. So keeping in the faith, which teaches you to put others first, has been a big help. I talked about the wrestling with the kids. One thing that we've always done and is communicate. Probably the best example is when we first got these two red chairs in our bedroom, and they're nice, comfortable chairs. And when I would come home from work, I would set aside the phone, the pager. Back then we had pagers, believe it or not.
What's that?
Yeah, I know. Set aside all this stuff and just talk. We called it red chair time. We've done, you know, praying together and reading the Bible together. But to be perfectly honest, I would like to say we've done more of that than we probably have. But we've definitely been very good at red chair time. And so that's almost metaphoric, but it's also, we had the red chairs, and so that's why we called it red chair time. So there'd be a certain amount of time every day where we would just talk. How was your day? What's the good, the bad? Jerry always called it roses and thorns, the good and the bad of the day. And we don't really sit in the red chairs to do that, but sometimes it's on the porch, sometimes it's walking down the street, whatever. But just time together. So that is very important in trying to put the other person first. There's different phases, as you kind of talked about in your life, where you've got more butterflies and times where you don't have as many butterflies, but keeping the love there and just developing that, having your dates, having your, you know, when you have young kids at home, it's especially important to be able to get a babysitter and go on dates. Even though the kids are going to cry, and we would walk out the door and listen and hear the kids crying, and we'd cry, of course. But then you went on the date, and that was so important. And it stays important no matter what. So just that time together, the communication, and doing corporate things together, like attending church, like doing Bible studies, I think it is very, very important.
Thank you for sharing that. Bruce, this has been an amazing time. Thank you for coming. You know, we have this, we call this the drop because it's a metaphor for men like you dropping wisdom in others' lives. So as being on here, I have the symbolic penny for you to drop in the jar.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Happy to do it.